Hello, and welcome to NDT Now's podcast, Level Up. I'm your host, Mary Beth Michelli. Today's podcast is brought to you by Edify Technologies, the world leader in advanced non-destructive testing solutions designed to always keep you beyond current. For more information, visit edify.com. Our Level Up podcast is like a virtual mentoring session with some of the top level threes in the world and the top NDT experts. And just to be clear, this podcast and any information provided herein is not intended to be formal training. On today's podcast, we have one of the most well-known NDTers in the world, Paul Holloway. He has over 5,000 subscribers on YouTube and is consistently keeping us informed on the ways of UT. Paul, thanks for being here today.
Thanks, Mary Beth. It's good to see you.
Good to see you. So, for those of us who follow you on LinkedIn and YouTube, and probably other platforms, I only follow you on those. It's been fun to watch your travels over the last year. You were at API, ASNT, NDTMA, APC NDT in Australia, and most recently in Edmonton for the CINDI conference. So besides getting your world tour t-shirt signed by folks, what else were you up to? Were you presenting at these conferences? What was going on?
So I got invited to a couple conferences that I hadn't been to before, and w for one of them I have you to thank. That was the NDTMA one. Usually I hit up the Canadian show, and which is the CINDI conference and the ASNT annual conference. I do those every year. But last year I went to API for my first time. That was in San Antonio. Beautiful, beautiful city. And then there was ASNT, and then there was NDTMA. And for those of you who have not been to NDTMA, it is really a different type of show than, because I'm so used to the CINDI show and the ASNT show. API is very similar. They're excellent. There's big exhibition halls, and there's technical talks, and you have to make sure you organize your time schedule correctly so you don't miss anything. And NDTMA is not like that. I was told ahead of time, you maybe told me, or some of my friends told me, it's really different. And I went and I thought, wow, this was one of the best shows I've ever been to because of the way it's scheduled. The fact that the exhibition hall is open for a period of like an interval, and then it's off, and then we all move over to technical tracks, and then it's back over. It's not like an ASNT sized conference. It's more intimate, but there's the engagement. That's where the big thing to me was. I can see you nodding. It was really surprising to me, because a lot of times at the other shows, I'll do a technical talk at a show, and I think this is gonna be great, and you get eight people, right? And you ah, why did like I fretted over this PowerPoint, and I practiced, and I get eight people, and six of them I know. And one of them's Nolan, and he's going to take pictures, you know. But NDTMA was extremely enthusiastic with the participation with the technical track. So, anyways, for those of you who have not been to NDTMA, it's excellent. And then, as you mentioned, APC NDT, again, another invitation. I went down actually to train a client in Perth for PA CAT, which is one of the other things. I sort of a sister company to Holloway NDT. They said, hey, while you're down here, you should really come with us to the booth at the APC NDT. And that was another really good show. Of course, it was a thrill to go to Australia, not having been before, right? And then I went, of course, to keep it local, I went back to the CINDI show, which I always support every year. Of course, I saw you there. And this year, I plan on not attending as many shows because the travel last year was a lot.
Yeah, I get that. And by the way, I did not pay Paul to say those nice things about NDTMA. I should just be clear.
Definitely, yeah, no. I'm pretty neutral when it comes to it's all honest.
So, were did you present at some of these conferences and I know it's Cindy, you presented on the UT limitations. So maybe tell us a little bit about that one and maybe some of the other presentations that you did.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I try to present at all of them because for me, it's probably 60% networking and 40% technical talks and trying to get what I have to say in front of some people and get feedback. So at all of them, I presented, and actually APC NDT went really, really well. And I did three talks because I thought if I'm going all the way to Australia, I'll talk three times. So I was went really well. So the one that I thought got the most, not necessarily traction, but the most, it was transferable to most of the people in the room because I can talk about PACAT. And I'm if there's a 500 people there's really maybe 25 to 50 people that know what that is and are interested to hear about it. Okay. And they have happened to remember the time on their watch and made it to the technical track, right? We know how that happens. TFMI, which was another thing that I worked on with sauna tests, and I try to talk about that every once in a while. So we had a good turnout at for that. But it was the UT basic stuff, which was one of my talks at Cindy and in Australia that got a lot of engagement, right? There's lots of good questions afterwards and the lots of people in the room. So that one was, and I know I've sort of beaten the horse a little bit a few times on YouTube and LinkedIn about limitations of UT and some misconceptions. But I had not formalized that into a presentation. So I did that talking in sort of in general terms at the beginning of the talk about some of the misconceptions in UT. Like we, for example, when we're doing UT training, we oftentimes draw the beam as a line. And the beam, sound goes down, sound goes up. And for the purposes of training, that's fair. But it's not an accurate representation of the beam. I think anybody, you ask any student, they'll say, well, of course, we know that it's not a laser beam. Right? But there's so much of the if-then-else statements, like if the beam is this line, then it does this and it bounces like this, else it does that. And it's you're sort of hinging everything that comes after it on a far too simplified metaphor or for lack of a better term, right? Representation. So I sort of start with that. And then I led on to, so what happens if that's not true? And what problems can you see down the road? And I think a lot of us encounter those things naturally on our own. We learn what we learn. For example, the analogy I have is a driver's license, right? You get a driver's license when you're 16. Me, I got it at 16 in 2 weeks. And I failed it the first time, but they let me take it 2 weeks later. So, woohoo, right? Got it 2 weeks after my 16th birthday. And they give you, at the time, there was no graduated licensing. So the piece of paper I had to legally drive on the road is probably the same piece of paper Mario Andretti had. Right? We're both allowed to drive a Toyota Camry. Well, he would not drive a Camry, but you get my point, right? The piece of paper's the same, but he was a much better driver than I was. So the analogy there is that when you get your UT2 ticket for the very first time and you go to scrub a weld, the only information you have in your head, the experiences and the history are all these simplifications that work well for the purposes of training and marking a test, but aren't particularly transferable to practical application. So I liken that to Santa Claus, and I try not to offend anyone when I do that. I told my kids about Santa Claus. It's fine. It's just a thing that a lot of people do, or they may use another thing that you tell kids, right? Easter Bunny or the Tooth Fairy, whatever, right? And it's a nice way to get a simple message across, like you better behave. Right. And we tell people these oversimplifications to make things easy to understand and sort of corral behavior in one direction. But you get out in the real world and you find out usually the hard way, unless you have a really excellent in-field mentor, which we don't have a great apprenticeship structure in NDT. We don't have a sort of a graduated mentorship program. It's sort of like, here's your driver's license, away you go, kid. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I learned the hard way. I think like a lot of people did, right? You sort of take one flaw, for example, and I talked about it in the videos, but the 6 dB drop technique for the sizing the length of a flaw, right? And it just won't work in a lot of cases, and it will, and you're kind of stuck because you've followed everything you were trained to do. And in fact, it actually goes back to the codes. Cause if you can imagine a giant Plinko game, you know Plinko from mm-hmm. The Price is Right.
Oh, yes.
For those of you who don't know what Plinko is, it's that giant tree of pegs, and they drop a ball at the top and it eventually lands in some container on the bottom. Right. And if you were to take the position of the ball at the bottom, you say it's in the wrong spot. We made an error and the ball is in a bad spot at the bottom. So what path did the ball take to get in the wrong spot? So you sort of have to reverse track the ball through the pegs, right? And get up to the top to find the root of the problem. And the root of the problem is, surprisingly, one of my slides in the presentation is showing people that this is written in the code. This is not an oversimplification that your UT instructor just decided was convenient for them. During the Australian presentation, when I was making it, I looked in my folder on my network drive for different codes and standards, right? And of course, you have them alphabetized. I'm sure you do too. And I went looked in the A's. And I looked in the A's, and I had, I don't know, it was probably 12 or 15 different codes that start with the letter A, probably more than that. And it was super easy to find five that are very commonly named, that everybody knows about, that literally have 6 dB drop written in the code. Like, this is the way to size a flaw. And some of them, actually, you trace them back, have pictures that show you, yeah, this is the echo dynamic, and you go to the spot of maximum amplitude, and then you go either direction, and there's the length of your flaw. And you think, okay, in a classroom setting, when we're dealing with machined or artificially manufactured flaws, like a lack of fusion, which may be by design 25 millimeters or an inch long, then it's fair to say that it may have been a copper shim, which was welded in the side of a bevel of a weld, and it very well may drop 6 dB, get close enough on either side that you get the length of it. But in the real world, the lack of fusion doesn't look anything like this. You do phased array training, and they give you the plate, and you're scanning, and they say, look at the giant red blob on the C scan, right? That's legitimately lack of fusion. You have no doubt about it. When you see that, it's lack of fusion. And then you get out. I remember the first time somebody was looking at a weld, and they pointed at this fuzzy little stuff, and they said, oh, it's lack of fusion all over the place. I'm like, no, I just took my course. I happen to know that's not lack of fusion. And they're like, no, it's definitely lack of fusion. And it's not until you sort of learn this stuff the hard way that you realize that, oh geez, like another one is a lot of the stuff we do in UT is amplitude based. So we call this usually a workmanship criteria, right? Just don't put stuff in the weld, right? It's not based on fracture mechanics. It's just, I call it, how loud is that sound? That's the game we play. Okay, so you are equating the severity of a flaw with how much sound it reflects. Okay, and I suppose if you were to dial back the time machine and go back to your first few days of understanding ultrasound, and somebody said to you, well, if it's a really bad flaw, it will reflect a lot of sound. And you go, well, of course it does. That only makes sense. Ultrasound is easy. And then when you get into the real world, you find that, okay, now take that weird little slag inclusion, which is sort of rolled around the bottom of a pass, and twist it 20 degrees. What's your signal look like? I get nothing. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. But guess what? It's still there. And well, how did, well, that's all right. That I must be doing something wrong. Like, no, you're actually doing everything right. This is just UT. So there's these Santa Claus things that we tell people at the beginning to try to make it easy to understand, and then later on, and it's almost cruelly, you have to unlearn. The you teach the puppy to pee on the newspaper, and then the puppy's like, oh, I got this. All right, newspaper, I pee, newspaper. And then you take the paper away, and then it's like, well, now what am I supposed to do? Now we're supposed to do it outside, but we spent 3 weeks on newspaper, right? So it's, and I put a lot of pictures in those presentations to try to make them easy to digest and somehow entertaining, if talking about ultrasound can be entertaining in the least. We try to keep them.
Well, I think you usually make it entertaining. That's why you have so many subscribers. I guess this leads me to my next point, and it's sort of related to what you've been saying, because I do think there's a disconnect between training and practice for UT in particular. There's just so many variables, and AS&T recently released their pass rate for their AS&T ISQ program for UT thickness, and in particular for the oil and gas industry. And so, with a passing rate of 39%, and that includes people taking it multiple times, that's their overall pass rate. Does this surprise you? I found it a little surprising for UT thickness. But since you are the UT guru, I thought I would go to the source.
Oh, I appreciate the comment. I don't know if I consider myself the UT guru. I learn a lot every time I talk to all sorts of different people, and then I think, geez, maybe what I'm thinking is not exactly correct. And I listen to Shane Walton more, right? Shane really knows his stuff. And then you listen to somebody else, and like, that guy also knows his stuff, and she really knows her stuff. And then, so we all learn from each other. So perhaps I'm just the loudest on YouTube. Maybe that's all. And it's funny that sometimes during the introduction to my talks, you have the little speaker bio, and they'll say, oh, he has a popular YouTube channel, and I always air quote around the word popular when they're talking in the background, because I think, oh, okay, well, 5,000 subscribers that want to talk about ultrasound on YouTube, yeah, okay, but there's some 7-year-old in her bedroom unboxing shoes who has 310,000 subscribers, so this is a very, very thin part of the pie. So I appreciate the fact that people are at least tolerate the silly YouTube videos. But so does it surprise me? It surprises me that it is that low. If you were to say, hey Paul, guess, just take a guess how low the pass rate is, I would say 60. When you said it was 39, I think it was 37% was the first, like if you take it for the first time, the pass rate was 37, and I believe those people who then took it again, the pass rate was only 42. And to me, that's the really surprising number, is that you get a second chance at it and your mark is basically the same. Now there's a couple things in here that are also additionally surprising. One is that I think written right into that instruction for the ISQ is that they're trying to use specimens for the test, which have an average score of between 50 and 80%. So it tells you how dire the situation is, because they can't even find those pieces. Because if they were able to find those pieces, then our marks would be somewhere between 50 and 80%. But they're 10% below that at the bottom end. So it suggests that the problem is pretty deep. It's not just a simple solution here. I believe that the number one fail reason for that test is characterization. So it's one thing to be able to correctly measure something but for thickness. Okay.
Right.
You can do echo to echo and set your velocity to 2320, and you're pretty much bang on, right? But for steel, being able to characterize is another thing altogether. The D meter will give you a number, but it won't tell you what it is. So there's some learning to, is there a repeating echo here that's very stable over some sort of region where I could justifiably call that a lamination? Or is that something that walks in from one side of the screen and then leaves, right? So I think this ultimately illuminates the fact that there's just insufficient training for the quality of UT inspection that is required. I mean, that's really all it boils down to. If the kid can't drive right, then the kid hasn't got the right training. So if we're not doing UT right, then we simply need more training. Now, in that respect, I actually mentioned this to the folks at the city conference. I'm like, can you believe these numbers? That's crazy. And then actually somebody stopped me and said, hey, did you know that in Canada, we are increasing the length of our UT level one training course from 5 days to 8 days? And I thought, as much as an employer doesn't want to, it's sort of bad news, right? I got to do another 3 days of training on top of that. I think it's impractical to expect that we can do an introduction to UT like you've never seen the machine. We come in on day one. You got to do 3 days of theory and 2 days of practical and push you out at the end of the fifth day and say, that's all the training you're ever going to get. So that's all your echo to echo, how to run a delay line, how to do a dually. How the heck do you plug a pen probe into a DL plus and make that thing, sing and dance? And then all of this stuff, like dual echo, the dual element transducers, there's so much that can go wrong with a dually. There's if you've got a D790, right, the one almost straight up and down, so there's very low roof angle. I know I'm speaking a little, everybody has to kind of close their eyes and imagine the roof of a house, and the peak is very flat. It's the angle at which the transmitter and the receiver are angled, because it's like you and I have a tennis ball and we're standing in front of the school wall, and I'm going to throw the ball to you and I'm going to bounce it off the school. If you and I are standing far back and we're relatively close together, I can throw the ball pretty much directly at the wall and it will, you'll kind of catch it. That's fine. But if you and I are right up close to the wall, right, then I kind of have to throw it at 45 degrees in order for you to catch it. So that's a very different roof angle. And the sort of smaller your dually is, and the sort of stubbier, the more the roof angle has to be pitched, the more mode converted waves you're going to get, which means your chances of doing the echo to echo are basically zero, which means that if you're running on a painted surface, all these things pile up. And it's just not conceivable that you could train all of this into a person in 5 days. Now, it's how long do you need? Well, how long do you want? You want to train somebody for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, 6 months? How long does it take to make a good UT thickness technician? Probably years. We're not going to train somebody for years in a classroom. So 8 days is better than five. So it boils down to basically just not enough training. And I think focusing on the practical aspects of the technique is important, because I think when we leave the, I always wanted to make a training course. In fact, I started one but never finished it, and I don't, I'd have to find the time to do this. But what I always wanted to do is make a training course so that when people left after 5 days, or now 8 days, perhaps, they left and I'd put them in coveralls. I would turn the lights out. I'd get them to lay on the floor and draw a grid on the bottom of a pipe, because this is going to be your job. You're on night shift, you're on a scaffold. There's a pipe that's 8 inches off the scaffold, and you got to squeeze your head underneath it and draw a grid on it, and then take accurate UT readings and reference everything to a weld. I'd love to do a training course like that. And you know what? If it took longer than the minimum amount of time, that's fine, because that's a minimum. It says nothing in the codes to say it's a 5-day training course plus or minus zero. It's a 5-day training course minus zero plus whatever you want.
Right. And actually, they showed that as well in the bridge industry, which is of course where I work. They took technicians, Glenn Washer from University of Missouri. He took technicians from the oil and gas industry and put them on the bridge and looked at the probability of detection. You know, they had known samples with known flaws in them and put them on a bridge. And just that change of environment, probability of detection went way down. I mean, it was really awful. And so there has to be, and I see that AS&T is trying to address some of this with personnel certification that's specific for sector, right? Sector qualification. But there has to be something on the training side that really, I would love to go into a training course where you start off day one, a little bit of theory and a little bit of practical, and then theory and practical, because almost when you front load it with all of the theory and then you go to the practical, you're not making that connection. So I also would love to do it. You know, like I just think that there's a better way of us as an industry addressing this because and of course the OJT, that is supposed to be where you get a lot of this, more of an art form rather than just technical knowledge. But it's a real problem. And I think that this pass rate highlights, and this is just UT thickness, if you think about that, right? Like this is sort of like the baseline. And then you have to go from there and do much more complicated inspections that are much more for critical applications that, we're talking public safety. And if we're not getting the right training and we're not doing the training in a way that people can digest it and utilize it, we're not living up to what we're making as our public promise to the world.
I find that when I went from conventional shearwave to phased array, there was a lot of lights that went on. And so in a way, I think technology is going to be helping us improve because there are things that happen on the beam periphery, which are not inherently obvious when you're doing like just regular shearwave, right? With an epoch or a wave. It just, you get lots of wiggles on the A scan, and people, again, back to the fact that a sound beam is not a laser beam, they need to appreciate the fact that the response we see on the A scan is a weighted average over the width and the height of the beam. It's a basically a an ovular, is that a word? Oval like, okay, sort of a globular ellipse of cloud of sound, which comes down and hits stuff. And if the thing that is in there has an advantageously oriented facet or blob, which happens to face back to your probe just at the right, but it's not in the middle, right? It's 3 millimeters off to the side and 2 millimeters down. It will appear on your screen like the loudest thing you've seen all day. So, and if you're doing a, for example, a fixed index scan, so phased array scan at a certain distance back, it's just a linear scan, swipe right through. You don't have the opportunity to raster or oscillate the transducer, so you get what you get, and you have to have that appreciation for whatever you're seeing on the screen is not necessarily directly in front of the probe, and phased array makes that so much easier because at least we have a ability to swing through the angles, and you can start to see things which are not inherently obvious with conventional. So when that happened for me, that's when all the lights started to turn on for tip diffractions. When somebody explained tip diffractions to me, and you find a lack of vision from one side of the weld, and you go, "Wow, well, that's a big red blob on the C scan because it's machined." And then my instructor had the probe on. We did a double scan, so we had the probe on the other side. And of course you do a beam plot and you go, "Well, I'm just not going to see it because it's not oriented the right way." He's like, "Oh no, you can see it." So he's like, go to exactly the position that it was on the other side and turn the soft gain way up. Okay, it's way up. And he says, you see those two little tiny, like tick marks, that just little tiny boom, boom. That's the tips. I'm like, that's the what? What? That I'm supposed to see that in the noise? But it's not until you are able to swing the angle cursor, study the A scan, and have it encoded into a B scan where you can start to see these little patterns emerge, stuff that you just would never see on conventional. So I'm hopeful that improving technology will help to pull that baseline up. Just give us better tools to do the job.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the use of AI, will be able to augment what the inspectors are looking at, right? We actually at the Cindy conference, they were the woman from API was talking about how they're using AI to proctor exams. I don't know if you were in this session, but it was really interesting because they were doing remote proctoring during COVID, and they've continued it, but they have an AI system that will tell them, hey, position five, student five is looking down too much over here, and you should pay attention to that spot. And so I think that as we move forward and we make strides in AI and sort of machine learning, and we will get a little more of like, hey, pay attention over here. This is what, yeah. So hopefully the technology will do that. And then maybe with the increase in training, and maybe it'll all come together, and the competency level will rise. That would be the hope, I guess.
I hope so too.
So I guess this really leads me to the next question is, and if we as an industry are not getting UT thickness right, how reliable are we when it comes to flaw detection and sizing?
Well, yeah, so let's zoom out to the training industry as a whole. So you've got your surface methods on your volumetric methods, and I think it's fair to say that something like eddy current and ultrasound are more, they're less tangible, they're more imaginative. You have to kind of be the beam in your head, close your eyes and imagine, right? And especially eddy current, which is just I have an eddy current ticket. I'm not it's not exactly my strong suit. Every time I do it, I have to really concentrate. Whereas ultrasound is more like riding a bike. Eddy current is like, okay, this is really hard to imagine what's happening here, right? So yeah, I think the surface techniques like dipenetrant and mag particle, which are much more tangible, the demonstrations you can do. For this is how mag works and this is how dye works, are very, you can look at them in the face and go, oh, wow, okay, I get it. Capillary action, I get it. And if you draw lines of flux for mag particle on a blackboard, that shows you how old I am. At least you're laughing with me and not at me. What would they do now? I don't know, some sort of smart board, okay? And you draw lines of flux. It would be a little bit strange for somebody to imagine that that's what's happening. But then you take the yolk and you pour the iron stuff and then you hit it from the bottom on the piece of paper and everything lines up. And then everybody goes, oh, yeah, right? And it becomes obvious. So I think if the techniques were taught in that order, like you should have a full handle on the mag particle stuff before we get into the UT stuff, especially for verification. It would make it a lot easier for verification of surface flaws to say, okay, we know that there's a crack on this weld right here. What happens with your UT probe when we do that? Right. So the sort of the order of operations. Whereas I don't, since I didn't take my NDT classes in a, in a college program, right? I took them individually, which I think a lot of people do. I'm not sure if in the college programs or in all of the college programs they do it. Like, we're going to do dipenetrant for the for this next month. That's all we're doing. Then it's mag, then it's U or RT, and then UT and Edgar. I don't know. I also think that one of them builds on the next one. So after you do your mag particle course, it doesn't mean that you're just okay, now you can forget about it because the next, 1.75 years, we're going to be doing other things. You've always got that yoke next to you, right? I always have a yoke in the truck. Well, it's not really a truck; it's a trucklet. It's a RAV. If I say truck, then the guys with people with real trucks go, "That's not a truck." All right, it's a RAV. But I always have the yoke there to back up the UT stuff. So, yeah, part of it is sort of the order of operations. And in you're right, what does this mean for shear wave? And which goes back to my point on the oversimplifications and the Santa Claus image. If we are more forthright with limitations at the beginning and don't try to, there's a delicate balance, right? Because you can't bombard somebody with hard physics and then expect that everybody's going to get that aha moment, right? There is a delicate balance, but if we are more honest and more illuminating with the limitations and the imaging, the metaphors and analogies that we use when we're training, then I think it becomes easier for people to digest the truth later because they haven't been led down the very simple path, which imagine a cart driving through mud, and you do it for years and years and years, and that lane at the farm is a foot deep on each, and it becomes very difficult to steer out of it. Whereas if we're more realistic with our training metaphors, then we are not so beholden to that old path, which when you find out in the real world that 6 dB drop kind of doesn't work very well or really at all. If you're measuring the length of a side drilled hole or a machined lack of fusion, then it'll work just great. But we then have to remember that the beam is not, again, the illustration in classes is always that the beam is this line, or if it's not a line, we look at say like a NDT setup builder or beam tool, and it's a infinitesimally thin slice through the weld. So then you if you can imagine yourself in 3D spinning on top of the probe, you go, oh, it's just an actual cross-sectional image of the, no, it's not actually. It's a weighted average across the width of the beam. So imagine that lack of fusion. You're trying to find the ends of it, but in the middle of the lack of fusion, it actually gets taller, right? Then it'll reflect more sound there, but that has nothing to do with the ends of it. So it's very much an understanding and balancing of these limitations, and perhaps teaching people. Like, I had to learn last significant echo technique on my own. You read some ISO standards, or you talk to your German friend, and he's like, you should look at this. And you look at that and go, oh, that makes a lot more sense, right? And then you start sizing things like that on a actually an encoded phased array scan. You go, wow, that does actually work. And it's much more accurate. Why didn't they tell me about that in the first place?
Yeah. And I do think it has to do with being overwhelmed, with information in the initial training too. So maybe there's like a secret handbook that can be handed out at the end. Read this the first week you're out. Read this the second week you're out. And you slowly peel back the information.
Yeah, I think the course notes that you get in your class, usually in a binder, right? A three-ring binder, and there's 100 pages in there. I don't
Now it's
know.
all digital, by the way.
Oh, are you kidding me? They changed that? Ah. So, man, I've really been stuck in the lab too long. So it would be nice. I've got this idea that someday I'm going to write a book, and it's going to be like a picture book. And I don't mean that to be an insulting, because for me, if I can't simplify it down to circle, square, triangle, then I just can't look at it. That's why all the videos are 5 minutes. That's why stuff is short and colloquial. Like if you want like hyper technical stuff with 85 references at the end and it's uploaded to ResearchGate or Elsevier, fantastic. I'm not your guy. Like I'm the one that's gonna talk to you in the presentation and in the little paper the same way that I'm gonna talk to you over a beer at the conference. That's just how it's gonna be. And I kind of get this idea in my head like a picture book. I know it sounds weird, but it's gonna be like just super basic stuff with just and every page is useful. And the type of thing where you don't have to memorize the words because it's so much easier to memorize a, everybody knows what Lake Louise looks like in Banff. Everybody, you see a picture and you're like, oh, I know what that, I've seen that picture before. And all the Canadians will go, ah, it's Lake Louise. We know that. So you don't have to describe it. You know, it's two mountains and the water's blue and they're kind of split in the middle and there's some rocks in the foreground and the sky's always blue, you know, nah, just the picture. So to me, it's just very basic images that carry a lot of weight within them. That don't have a lot, because a lot of people don't read the words afterwards. You read them in class to get you through the 2 weeks, and then it's over. I'd like to have something with you that when you're done, you clutch that book like this is going to get me through the next 2 years, right?
Yeah.
Someday.
I'm totally a visual person, so that would be, and I think a lot of NDTers are. So, you know, I think that's actually a really great idea. So, lastly, I always like to have some sort of personal interest in our podcast. And we know that UT is your passion. But can you tell us about something you do for fun outside of work?
Well, I'm lucky enough that I actually work from home. So the lab at Holloway NDT is my converted garage. So I'm fortunate enough to do this thing that I love and earn a modest living at it while being close to my family. So even though there's lots of travel, the industrial tourist thing that happens with NDT, I am fortunate enough that my commute is very short. So I enjoy working at home and not having to drive in Toronto traffic, which I know is not anything close to what you may experience in LA, but it's bad enough. So yeah, I enjoy the family time, and I also do. I've always been in music, so maybe there's the sound tie-in thing. I was sort of forced for a while as a young stubble jumper to take piano lessons. And I managed to do that all the way through school, but not particularly adept, but adept enough to have an appreciation for music. I think a lot of people in NDT are actually into music. I understand Dave Mandina is quite the drummer, and
Oh, he's excellent.
I think we I gotta go see that. There's no way I could jam with him because I'm awful at that, but I'd love to see it. So I do. I have done the band thing before, and I have a project right now with my buddy Alex in Brazil. It's actually the web page is actually tagged onto the backside of the Holloway NDT website because I'm too cheap to buy another more web service. So the band project is called Skeptosphere. It was Skeptosphere, and Alex is a guy that I when I was in Edmonton, I had a band, and Alex was the singer. And then afterwards, we just kept in touch after he moved back to Brazil, and I moved from Edmonton to outside Toronto, and then we sort of just, you know, plucked away at it for the over the years, and then eventually decided to hire a real drummer, and he's actually in California. Is
Nice.
yeah, his name's Mark Zonder. He's actually a sort of a drum hero of mine. He played in a band called Fates Warning, and then Warlord, which was a like a popular '80s sort of heavy metal sort of underground thing. Excellent, and sort of a drum hero of mine, and he played the drums, and then we had to redo everything because we realized that we were in way over our heads after we heard the drum track. So we just did an EP, and that's a it's a lot of work, but both of us are full-time jobs. We're not 18-year-olds, you know, trying to make it. We're professionals that sort of noodle in the side time. So that. That's fun. And Alex does the videos and sort of pieces together montages of stuff. And yeah, good times.
Well, I'll have to check it out. I also play eight instruments.
You play eight instruments. Not only are you a martial arts expert, but you're a talented lady.
I like to stay busy, you know. I don't get to play most of them that much anymore. Lately, it's just sort of, you know, singing and flute playing because that's what happens at church. So
So give
that's.
me okay, so give me the most common instrument to the most rare. Because when you say eight, I could say, okay, guitar, piano, maybe play flute or trumpet. But then you say eight, I'm like, okay, one of them is like some sort of strange Japanese 11 and a half stringed instrument that you play behind your head. Like, what is
No, there's not like a weird instrument, but I mean, like, yes, flute and piano were sort of like the first, right? And then, you know, I played bass guitar, I played baritone saxophone when I was starting at age eight. So I had to stand up to play it because it was too, you know, all four, or I guess four of the many recorders, you know, all the different recorders. And I played tuba for a while and trombone, and I'm sure I'm missing something.
I think what we
So
need is you and Dave Mandina in a ragtime revival at the next conference.
would be awesome. And actually my daughter's now playing trombone, and my son's playing violin, so I'm enough to be dangerous on those at this point. It's a good time. It's a good time.
Nice. Good to hear.
Yeah. So, well, I want to thank you for being here today. This was really great, and I'm glad we could finally catch up. And I know a lot of my listeners really are also your viewers, so this will be they'll kill two birds with one stone this week, I guess. So thank you for joining us, and we look forward to your next YouTube video, which we always cover on NDT Now. For a while, you were like out in the field doing stuff, and I was very annoyed because I was like, what's happening? Where's
That
Paul? I need
that's
him.
why I did that. I did a occasionally, I think I do a video in the field. I've done a few of them offshore. I do some offshore work. So I
Yeah.
did one purposely in orange coveralls
Yes.
because, yeah, well, it was sort of we had like a lunch and I ate lunch very fast and then ran back to the office and set the camera up on the garbage can and filmed this video because I had people asking me like, so you do most of your stuff is at home? I'm like, no, actually, most of my stuff's in the field. Like my coveralls are dirty and there's my boots and my back of my trucklet's got my UT stuff in it. And most of this time I'm busy. And there's a misconception that because you have a green screen and some studio lights, you must be home all the time. So I'm no, and I'll prove it. I'll make a video in orange coveralls about DLA probes or something, right?
Yeah, we should just stick a GoPro on you at all times and just have you.
Yeah. No. Too boring. You should see the amount of edits I have to make for a video. It's really bad. It's 1 hour of taping makes a 5 hour video and or sorry, 5 minute fit sorry, 1 hour of taping, 5 minute video, about 6 hours to mix it, and half an hour to make an annoying thumbnail.
Oh,
It's
well, we
awful.
appreciate it. I at least at NDT Now, we definitely appreciate it, and I think the entire industry appreciates what you put out there. So thank you so much.
Thank you. It's sort of a labor of love, but it's fun, and I could do it right here in the lab slash garage, so I really don't have to go anywhere. It's supposed to be rainy this weekend, so I think I'll do one.
Oh, excellent. Well, and thank you all to our listeners today. Remember to join us every month here at ndtnow.com, brought to you by Edify Technologies. Learn more at edify.com.